This is History's Hidden Killers. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Before I tell you about a man who knocked on the door, you need to know who was inside, because everybody who knows about serial killers knows the name Richard Speck. Almost nobody remembers their names, the victims, or the ones who survived. This is Surviving Serial Killers. There are five-part series this week with History's Hidden Killers. Taking a look at five stories of people who lived through the worst night imaginable. The thread that runs through every one of them is the same. They saved themselves because no one else was going to do it for them. That's what Corazon Amaro did to survive. And what Corazon Amaro did to survive was the opposite of every survival instinct in the human body. She did nothing for 6 hours, and it kept her alive. We're going to talk about exactly what happened and how she survived, how she did just that. But first, the women. Pamela Wilkling was 20 years old. She wrote in her nursing school application that she hated seeing people suffer. That's why she wanted to be a nurse, described by everybody who knew her as sweet, funny, and genuinely kind. Patricia Matuska's 20, Chicagoan, champion swimmer, talented enough for the high school water ballet team, engaged to a fellow nursing trainee. The afternoon of July 13th, 1966, Patricia found out she'd been accepted to the staff at Children's Memorial Hospital. She went to bed that night with her whole career in front of her. Suzanne Ferris was 21, one of three children engaged, planning a spring wedding. She wanted to be a pediatric nurse. Mary Ann Jordan, 20, didn't even live in the townhouse she was visiting that night specifically to discuss Suzanne's wedding, because Suzanne was marrying Mary Ann's brother, two families about to become one. Mary Ann was there to plan a celebration. Gloria Jean Davey, 22, one of six children, president-elect of the Illinois Student Nurses Association. She'd been named a national sweetheart of the Future Farmers of America. She planned to join the Peace Corps after graduation. Then you had Nina Schmel, 24, the eldest, engaged to her high school sweetheart. Her classmates had voted her queen of the nurses' spring dance. From the Philippines, Merletta Garalgo, 23. She brought bamboo crackling poles from Manila and performed the tinkling dance at parties. She cooked adobo and planted for the whole house, and the American nurses loved it. Corazon Amaro recalled it later. When Merletta cooked adobo and pancit, they came home from the hospital and smelled the food, and they said, "It's good." So we invited them to join us to eat, and they really liked it. It was a good time that we had. Valentina Passion was 23, a lawyer's daughter from Isabela, graduated in the top of their class in Manila. She wrote letters home telling her parents she wished they could stay in America forever before that night was over. She'd written one more letter promising to send money to fix the family house. Eight women, ages 20 to 24, student nurses at South Chicago Community Hospital, weeks from graduation. They lived together at 2319 East 100th Street in the South Deering neighborhood. They shared meals and shifts and wedding plans and the ordinary work of becoming the people they were going to be. The ninth woman in that house was Corazon Amaro, 23, exchange nurse from San Luis in the Philippines. She'd been in the United States for 2 months, 2 months. She was still learning their routines, still getting used to Chicago summer, still figuring out this enormous country that she had landed in. And July 13th, 1966, a scorching summer night in Chicago around 11 p.m., someone came knocking. Richard Speck, 24, a drifter out of Kirkwood, Illinois, over 20 arrests by 25 alcoholic, violent, criminal record across multiple states, burglary, forgery, attacking a woman. He'd worked on a Great Lakes cargo boat, so he knew how to tie nautical knots. He had a tattoo on his left forearm, born to raise hell. He'd spent that evening drinking hard at several bars that night before he showed up at the townhouse with a gun and a knife. He told the women he needed money, just enough for a bus ticket to New Orleans, he said. He wasn't going to hurt anyone. He just needed the cash. They gave him money. He didn't leave. One of the American nurses answered the door. Speck did not force his way in violently. He came in almost politely. It's part of what made the next 5 hours so incomprehensible. Corazon and the other Filipino nurses, Merlita and Valentina, retreated to a closet. A roommate coaxed them out. Stay calm. He just wants cash. Give him the money and he leaves. The American nurses spoke to the Filipino nurses reassuringly. This was manageable. This was just a robbery. Speck tied all of them with strips torn from bed sheets using the nautical knots. Herded them into one bedroom around midnight. Three more nurses came home before curfew. Gloria, Suzanne, and Marianne. They walked straight into it. Speck tied them too. Then he started taking them out of the room one at a time. 20 to 30 minutes between each one, none of them came back. The women still in the room heard muffled sounds from elsewhere in the house. Not one of them screamed as she was led away. They went quietly because they believed cooperation was safety, because the man, he said he wouldn't hurt them. Because that's what you do. Comply and survive. They complied, but they did not survive. Over the course of 5 hours, from roughly midnight to 5 a.m., Speck took them from one room at a time, 20 to 30 minutes apart, and killed them. He strangled 5, stabbed 3. He used nautical knots and bed sheets and a knife and his own hands. He was methodical enough to keep going for 5 hours, but sloppy enough to lose count of how many women he'd tied up. He lost count. He was drunk. He was disorganized. 9 women were in that house. He killed 8. The 9th, Corazon Amoro, had rolled under a bunk bed while he wasn't watching. She laid there from midnight until 6 a.m. 6 hours. No movement, no sound. Not a whisper, not a shift of weight, not a single muscle tensing in a way that could be heard. She could not see what was happening in the other room. She could hear enough. She knew the sound. She knew nobody was coming back. She knew she was the only person still breathing in that house. And she chose to override every instinct in her body. The one screaming, run, fight, scream, do something. And instead, she did the only thing that would keep her alive. She became invisible. And that invisibility, the ability to control her own breathing, her own heartbeat, her own presence in a room, was the only weapon she had. It was enough. A drunk killer who couldn't count to 9 never came looking for the one he missed. Around 6 a.m., silence. Corazon moved for the first time in 6 hours. She crawled out from under the bed. The house was silent. She found Suzanne Ferris in the hallway near the bathroom. She found Patricia, Marianne, and Pamela in the east bedroom, Nina, Valentina, and Merlita in the west bedroom. Gloria elsewhere. Every room she entered had another friend on the floor. The girl who wanted the Peace Corps. The swimmer who got her dream job that afternoon. The bride and the future sister-in-law who came over to plan the wedding. The nurse who hated seeing people suffer. The one who danced at parties and cooked for the house. The one who wore and the one who wrote home about loving America. The one engaged to her high school sweetheart. 8 women, all gone, all killed in the same house on the same night while a stranger worked room by room for 5 hours. Corazon climbed into a second-story window ledge, and she screamed until the neighbors came. Police arrived to a scene that the Cook County coroner would later describe by saying it should be called the crime of the century. 8 young women, all student nurses, all found in the bedrooms of a townhouse. Corazon, still in shock, gave officers a detailed description, his face, his build. The one detail that cracked the case, a tattoo on his left forearm that read, born to raise hell. The sketch ran on the front page of every Chicago paper the next day. 2 days later, a man named Claude Lunsford recognized Speck from the sketch. Speck, meanwhile, had tried to end his own life in a hotel room and was taken to the Cook County Hospital. Surgical resident Dr. Leroy Smith spotted the tattoo from the newspaper reports and called police. Speck was arrested on July 17, 1966, 4 days after the killings. The tattoo that Corzine described from memory under unimaginable stress in a language that wasn't her first was the detail that identified him. Her description was that precise. April 15, 1967, the trial. Corzine Amora was the prosecution's entire case, the only living witness. She was calm, precise. She described the night from start to finish. Then she stood up from the witness box, crossed the courtroom, walked directly at Richard Speck, stopped close enough to nearly touch him, and said four words. This is the man. The jury convicted Speck on all eight counts of murder, sentenced to death, later committed to multiple life sentences. After the Supreme Court's ruling, Speck died of a heart attack on December 5th, 1991, one day before his 50th birthday. 24 years in prison. He never expressed remorse for anything he did in that house. Here's a part of the story almost nobody knows. Corzine went home to the Philippines. She worked as a nurse at Far Eastern University Hospital in Manila. She married a lawyer named Alberto. They had two children, became a local counselor in her hometown. Years later, she returned to the United States and worked at Georgetown University Hospital in Washington, D.C. She accepted $5,000 from the $10,000 reward offered by South Chicago Community Hospital, and she turned down everything else. Books, interviews, documentaries, appearances, film deals. For 60 years, six decades, Corzine Amora refused to sell the worst night of her life. She pointed at the man who killed eight women she had cooked dinner with and shared a house with and was beginning to call friends. She said four words. She went home, and she chose silence for the rest of it. She's reportedly still alive, in her 80s, still private, still silent. She knew Merlita's cooking. She knew Valentina's letters home and the money she planned to send for her family house. She knew Patricia got the job at Children's Memorial that afternoon. She knew Suzanne was planning a wedding and that Marianne came over that night to help plan it. Marianne didn't even live there. She knew Pamela hated seeing people suffer and Nina was engaged to her high school sweetheart and Gloria wanted to see the world with a Peace Corps. She didn't just survive the night Richard Speck killed eight women. She survived knowing exactly who they were and what they were about to become. She lay under her bed for 6 hours. She came out and found her friends in every room. She climbed onto a ledge and screamed. She gave the police what they needed. She testified in open court. She pointed at the man who did it. She said the four words, and she spent 60 years saying no to everyone who wanted to say anything more. That silence isn't a footnote to the Richard Speck case. That silence is the story of the woman who survived it. Next up on Surviving Serial Killers in our History's Hidden Killers series, a college kid on his knees beside railroad tracks in Kentucky, hands bound behind his back, told his girlfriend five words. He was dead within minutes. She crawled 200 yards with a shattered jaw. That's next. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. We'll continue our conversation there. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.